as being more than just material stuff built up to, you know, cross a river.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand it to be more than that, then you have some sort of deeper relationship with that thing.
Yeah.
That isn't really dependent on distance. Right? Like, I think maybe like part of the confusion is like the way he's using the term closeness,
mm-hmm.
there, where it's like you think about it in terms of like a distance, and yeah, he's kind of comparing it to someone who's like literally on the bridge. But I think what he's also saying is that like someone who doesn't really understand the nature of the bridge and the nature of their relationship to it doesn't really have access to it at all, other than it being a river, like some river crossing.
Yeah, or
right? Just like any other.
Yeah, or it's this kind of raw material, or I can't speed past this limit on it, or something like that. You know, they have some familiar understanding of it.
You know, I think with these sorts of things with Heidegger, sometimes I actually think the best example is art.
Hmm.
And it's like, look, if let's say I'm someone who has a deep appreciation for artwork, I'll use the example of Starry Night.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a deep appreciation of artwork. You know, I've gone and seen Starry Night. I've seen many millions of representations from it. I have this like deep emotional connection and understanding and relationship with the work of art. Regardless of where I am, that relationship is like quite profound and is there, and I get it. Now we go to someone else, let's say, who's actually with the painting, perhaps have taken it down, and is focused on understanding the various chemical compounds of the pigment.
Yeah.
But could care less about the actual work of art itself, mm-hmm. as an aesthetic piece. You know, who's got the closer relationship with the, you know, artwork as it's like revealed as art?
Mm-hmm.
Well, like, obviously it would be me, and not the person who's more interested in which like chemicals they can find in the, you know, yellow pigment in the moon or whatever.
Yeah, so that takes us a bit into what Heidegger says allows for this. Because I think what we are talking about is when Heidegger uses this term nearness, this is not the same thing as a derivative proximity. The spatial relations that we call, you know, space or extension, these are derivative of more originary experiences, which I used some terms when I was quoting that to talk about locales, but a locale being a sort of more primary experience of space than the mere extension that we can measure. So we might be able, like, you absolutely can measure proximity. We have rulers and stuff like that. But I think the nearness that Heidegger is talking about is the nearness to this experience of presence that I'm thinking about. So I'm thinking about this bridge. I'm thinking specifically about the bridge in downtown Courtney, the sort of teal, green bridge. And I can think of all kinds of things about it that make it meaningful. And one of the things that Heidegger talks about in this specific essay is, okay, what are the conditions for that meaningfulness in being near things? And Heidegger ultimately is going to say that a thing is a, so this is an interesting kind of method that Heidegger uses. He essentially uses an etymological or he investigates the language, and he comes up to the realization that a thing is an assembly, or it gathers something. To the question, well, what does a thing gather? For Heidegger, that thing gathers what he calls a fourfold.
Well, obviously, we're going to talk about the fourfold now.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of his explications, basically, of being.
Mm, yeah.
Which has always been his like project and his kind of revolved in many different ways, the sort of the most basic ontological project. It's a very interesting breakdown. It's still like pretty cryptic.
What exactly is the fourfold?
This is on page 351.
Yeah, page 351. We're reading from the basic writings It's a probably, if you're going to get your hands on some Heidegger, that's probably the first thing you should get, other than the introduction to metaphysics.
He says, by a primal oneness, the four, earth and sky, divinities, and mortals, belong together in one.
Mm-hmm.
So then he goes on to say, earth is the serving bearer, blossoming and fruiting, spreading out in rock and water, rising up into plant and animal. When we say earth, we are already thinking of the other three along with it, but we give no thought to the simple oneness of the four. The sky is the vaulting path of the sun, the course of the changing moon, the wandering glitter of the stars, the years, seasons, and their changes, the light and dusk of day, the gloom and glow of night, the clemency and inclemency of the weather, the drifting clouds and blue depth of the ether. When we say sky, we are already thinking of the other three along with it, but we give no thought to the simple oneness of the four. The divinities are the beckoning messengers of the Godhead. Out of the holy sway of the Godhead, the God appears in his presence or withdraws into his concealment. When we speak of the divinities, we are already thinking of the other three along with them, but we give no thought to the simple oneness of the four. The mortals are the human beings. They are called mortals because they can die. To die means to be capable of death as death. Only man dies, and indeed continually, as long as he remains on earth, under the sky, before the divinities. When we speak of mortals, we are already thinking of the other three along with them, but we give no thought to the simple oneness of the four. This simple oneness of the four we call the fourfold. Mortals are in the fourfold by dwelling, but the basic character of dwelling is safeguarding. Mortals dwell in the way they safeguard the fourfold in its essential unfolding. Accordingly, the safeguarding that dwells is fourfold.
It's interesting because in certain ways it's poetic. I would say it is a bit cryptic if you are hunting for some meaning behind it. If, you know, what is Heidegger going on about here? I do think that Heidegger, when he says, you know, the sky is the sun and the moon, the earth is the blossoming fruits, are they metaphors? I don't know. In any case, I think that what's going on with the fourfold is that if a thing gathers the fourfold and being can be thought of in this fourfold way, that there's a certain way in which the presence of things, this experience that we have when we stop trying to derive things from things, when we really cross a bridge and experience the bridge that we're on or that we're approaching, when we think of that bridge or when we encounter that bridge as presence, or when we presence ourselves to that bridge in certain ways, the fourfold is the condition for the possibility of the meaning of that bridge or the presence of that bridge. And I'm thinking specifically, so Heidegger says that when we think of one of them, we think of the others as well. And in a certain way, I think that's true. So I think about, like, let's think about the earthly materiality of it, right? The fact that we take things from the earth and we structure them and we have pigments that fit into any given surrounding and it bridges two spots. But then when we do that, we're also thinking about the occasions that these arise. So this is relating heaven and earth. I'm thinking specifically of when, because we do have to think about particulars, because this is where the meaning comes from. If we were to just think about an abstract bridge, well, then you're not going to get any meaning out of it. But when you're relating to a particular bridge, think about events that pass by the bridge. So I'm thinking in Courtney, I haven't looked into this to see if this still is an event, but I remember when I was young, there was an event called the Ducky 500. I don't really remember. I don't know if it was a charity event or if it was just a community event, but I remember seeing all these yellow ducks come float underneath the bridge across the Lewis River. I would be at Lewis Park and you would watch all of these ducks go underneath it. I don't know if this is exactly what Heidegger means by sky, but I'm relating it into that. This is a thing that charts its course along the year. This occurs and it occurs again. It has a certain regularity and tempo in the life that the mortals live. And again, when we think of the one, we think of the other four. It's the mortals who live this time out. And as we think about the structure of the way that this bridge stands here, persistent, enabling things, but also participating in the life of those mortals who use it, we really do get a sense of the meaning of this bridge when we think about those importance, you know, and now we're talking about subjective or derivative terms. This is where those subjective qualia come from. This is what structures those. You don't have to appeal to anything derivative. You can just think about the bridge and its meaning, and you can approach it in it. You can approach its presence by contemplating the meaning. And here's one way of doing it, or here is what structures that meaning. It's the fourfold.
Yeah, I think you really got to it there, and I kind of imagine it, like, thinking back to it, the Stone article, Lawrence's article. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, what does when we're just going about our day, when we're not trying to take this, you know, the scientific step back, when we're not trying to be the objective observer, right? When we're just, you know, participating in the world, perhaps I've in Heidelberg and walking across the bridge. I actually have been to that exact bridge.
Really?
Not that yeah.
Wow.
You know, what is actually structuring my attention, mm-hmm. right? Like what's the character? What is the quality of that attention? And obviously there's some really deep relational stuff going on, but there's also, you know, within the context of the article, there's quite a lot of discussion of something called, like, you know, like space versus like a locale, right?
Yeah.
And what makes something like a location? And I think it was actually might be useful to just briefly read again from the work.
Sure. Yeah.
Heidegger says a little bit later on in the essay, a bridge may serve as an example of our reflection. Talking about bridges a lot in this episode, obviously.
Yeah.
The bridge swings over the stream with ease and power, he says in quotes. Mm-hmm. It does not just connect, which is funny that he says it swings over the stream because it's a stone bridge.
Yeah.
But it does not just connect banks that are already there. The banks emerge as banks only as the bridge crosses the stream. The bridge expressly causes them to lie across from each other. One side is set off against the other by the bridge. Nor do the banks stretch along the stream as indifferent border strips of dry land. Mm-hmm. With the banks, the bridge brings to the stream the one and the other expansive landscape lying behind them. It brings stream and bank and land into each other's neighborhood. The bridge gathers the earth as landscape around the stream.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that really gets at this notion for Heidegger that, you know, entities, our activity and our activity with entities really brings meaning to the spaces that they're at, those locales, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I kind of like how he says, you know, like the banks of the stream, like they're only concerned as banks, they're only concerned as borders, you know, once they are recognized as such and interacted as such through something like a bridge, right?
Yeah, once they're related, like, to each other.
Like, there's no... But that relationship, like, there's relationships in Heidegger's perspective are always, I think, mediated by mortals. Like, he's saying, like, within the context of a fourfold, you know, you can look at each individual part, but one part, the other four parts are always going to be there.
Yeah.
And one of those parts is mortals and their relationships and interactions with stuff. And that means that, like, yeah, like, it's through our activities and the tools that we use and the artifacts that we participate in and the buildings that we create that locations become more than just like a kind of Kantian spatial plane.
Yeah. Well, because you need, well, the thing is, I would say, because I think you're right. I think the, I think what you're getting at is correct, but Heidegger would say that it's actually the, it's not that the locales are more than the space. The extension, the abstraction is technically more. What is simpler, what is more primary is those locales. So once you have these sites of activity, these relationships along the land that establish themselves, that's when you start having multiple points. You can think of it geometrically even. Then you have these lines that connect to each of them, and then you start getting these ideas about spatiality and extension and proximity and distance. Those derive from the fact that we exist in different parts of our world first, and then distance emerges. Distance isn't there, and then the quality of locations gets tacked on. Spatiality derives from our opening up sites for gathering, the fourfold.
To kind of expand on that and go in, you might say, the other direction or the other dimension is probably the other way of putting it. When reading through this essay again, after it's been a while since I've looked at it, you know, like we were saying earlier, this, the fourfold involves sky, earth, mortals, and divinities.
Mm-hmm.
I started to realize, at least through this reading, that I think sky has a very distinctly temporal component to it.
Yeah.
You know, the night to day, the changing of seasons, you know, the transitional periods, all this is really emphasized in sky. And I think that is kind of Heidegger's way of structuring not only that is, you know, our is being a temporal, but it's also temporal in the sense that it has a certain rhythm or beat,
yeah,
that it goes to within the context of an actually existing world, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that there's kind of like the same thing with, like what you're saying with you know locales versus, you know, spatial extension. There's also, like, you know, we have a tendency to think of time as clock time, mm-hmm, right? As that measured time, as atomic time, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, obviously the more primary way we live time is, you know, through the sort of rhythm of the natural world, through the rhythm of life, through the rhythm of social relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the primary way that people interact with their, that, like, I don't even say that people interact with their temporality, that temporality just, like, is. Right, like that's,
yeah,
how we pervade through the world as temporal beings, is through this kind of rhythmic movement of time.
Yeah, and it goes, that rhythmic sort of structure to time, it goes a long way to explaining how it could be there before a linear conception of time. I mean, with the linear conception of time, there is this question of, okay, well, when did it start? But if you only just have this first primary experience of an eternal recurrence of rhythm and circularity, there's no, you can't really have a question of the origins of that time. You can have narratives that, like, I'm thinking specifically of like Mesopotamian, you know, religion or mythology, where their gods are intertwined with their agricultural practices and whatnot. You have an emerging story that explains where this arose, but there aren't the same rigid intellectual problems that you encounter once you enter that derivative secondary experience of linearity, in extension, a linearity in activity as sort of a means-end relation. Your relations are circular in that you will create something and then it will be destroyed, but it will be replenished. So circularity, but also not circularity. Well, the circularity is really only fallacious, or there's a problem with it once you're in that secondary way of viewing things, but once you enter that primary way of seeing time as always already existing and moving, a sort of eternal movement. I'm kind of running with something that you said, but I'm trying to draw it towards the theme of the eternal recurrence.
I think that you hit the nail on the head, and even for our listeners, it's because I think sometimes the struggle I've even had with Heidegger in the past, which is, it's so, like, you're talking about stuff that's like so kind of like basic, like the sort of like the rhythm, the movement of time, and these sort of like reoccurring cycles that we all go through, that actually trying to explicate them sometimes can be kind of tricky, like I've always found. We're going to skip over mortals. We just don't have time to talk about it. What is your sense of what Heidegger's talking about with divinities? Because this has been always, within the context of the fourfold, this has always been like the pillar that I have been like, what is he talking about?
Right.
Sometimes my pessimistic side has come up and said, is this a reflection of Heidegger's own existence in a more, from a more religious background and religious world, where there needs to be some sort of insertion of a religiosity within the structure? Like, is that reflective of his own, what we might call, like, bias? Or is there something more going on? I've never actually been able to, like, brush that aside.
Yeah, so I think that divinities, maybe this is a bit basic, but I'm just going back to when we were reading those passages, those iterative passages. The divinities are the beckoning messengers of the Godhead. Out of the holy sway of the Godhead, the God appears in his presence, or withdraws into his concealment. So the thing that I'm seeing here is, again, to bring this back to Lawrence Berger, presence and concealment. In a certain way, any time that you experience the presence of a thing, that thing in itself, that is when you're experiencing the presence of the tree, you're not just encountering through some kind of mediated form the divinity. You are experiencing the presence of that tree, but the presence of that tree, again, if we're to think of it as emerging from the earth, having a rhythm in time, it blooms, it sheds its leaves, and mortals have a relationship, and even it is mortal. Trees die. Well, they don't die the way that mortals die.
They don't die a proper death.
Yeah, they
a
don't.
Real death.
They can't have a tree. A tree can't have a good death, but it can. It can, I suppose.
It does expire.
Yeah, it expires. But it's obviously, if Heidegger is right that when we think of the earth, we're thinking of mortals, well, we will think of the mortals who use the tree towards their good death. But to account for the divinities, I think that in part is the presence felt by the tree, or felt, sure, maybe felt by the, well, maybe felt by the tree of us or its environment. But when we encounter the tree, I think that that accounts for what we sometimes experience as awe-inspiring. When we feel respect, it wouldn't just be an aesthetic shame, or it wouldn't just be unfair if a given tree was cut down. We really think that something important would be lacking. We think that some presence would be taken away from any given space, depending if the tree belongs there or something like that. But I think that the divinities here, because Heidegger is talking about a presencing of and the withdrawal of something that we feel is there, I think that is that dimension of the fourfold at play.
I think I kind of grasp it, but it's still, I sometimes wonder what the necessity is of that aspect, and could you like basically knock out one and make it a threefold?
For Heidegger, he would say no, because what I'm doing is phenomenology, and I'm trying to describe the world, and what I when I go out into the Black Forest and I go to this ancient tree that inspires in me an awe that there is a desire to honor it in some way, so I write a poem, or I spend time with it, or I have a certain kind of respect for it, or I know its neighbors or something like that. I think that is one of the dimensions that Heidegger is trying to account for. I think if you were to knock it out, what you would be knocking out is one of actually the most important things that Heidegger is trying to account for. And that is, again, to kind of, we've been talking about this the whole time, our experience of encounter and presence in things. I mean, if you could account for that in terms of encountering the earth, maybe. But then again, I think it goes back to this idea of, well, the earth, it really is just the blossoming fruit. When you think of the earth, you also think of the divinities, and that part is what is there. That's me trying to understand why Heidegger has the divinities. And I should say, too, the divinities, so I understand the fourfold to kind of be a two-part twofold. Heaven and earth form a pair. Divinities and mortals form a pair. So I think also that maybe there is a kind of religious bent to it, because Heidegger does see us as being in some essential relationship to divinities that we might not necessarily think as necessary or even reflective of our own experience. But I do think that Heidegger thinks that.
The seeing them as a pairing is probably a good step towards making sense of it.
Hmm.
Like, basically, you said, like splitting up the fourfold into two pairs,
yeah,
in some sense, and makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and the only not the only reason, but one of the reasons I do that is because when you read Chinese philosophy, so, like, heaven and earth, that it gets invoked so much to just mean all that is. So I naturally see, when I see heaven and earth, I just very naturally think of a pair totalizing the entirety of existence. And maybe Heidegger thinks that divinities and mortals do that as well. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. We've been discussing Heidegger, specifically in relation to Lawrence Berger's essay, Being There, Heidegger on Why Our Presence Matters, and we supplemented it with some of our readings from Building, Dwelling, Thinking.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiserwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Learning a new trade and being the new person on a job site can be hard, especially if there's nobody else there who looks like you. Native American women working in solar may know the feeling well.
They might be the only woman, they might be the only brown person in their group of installers that they'll be working with.
Alicia Hayden is with Red Cloud Renewable, a Native-led nonprofit based in South Dakota. The group runs free solar workforce training programs, including one specifically for Native American women. For graduate Jacinta Goggles, learning alongside other Native women created camaraderie.
There's a certain kinship you feel, and I think that ability to be so comfortable with each other very quickly was a huge factor in all of our success, because all of us wanted each other to succeed.
And Hayden says participants leave the program connected with other participants and with mentors already working in the field.
In their cell phone, they have the names of 15 new friends they just made, some of which are Native American women who have been working in this industry for 10 years that are just a phone call or a text away.
So even if they're the only Native woman on a job site, they can feel supported, connected, and less alone. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Hi, we're Young Liars.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist, featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. Fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.